This episode of The Constant is brought to you by the Whatever Happened To series for the young and easily influenced. Envision a future where our most popular children's books are written by today's Tomi Lahrens, Dennis Pragers, and Karl Roves. It may sound horrible, but the creators of the Whatever Happened To series have made it hilarious. Like Rolling Together 1984 and Everyone Poops, they've created a series of parody books that boil down for future generations whatever happened to insects, Mexican food, nipples, even colonoscopies, and explain away the end of the world in the most simplistic, unscientific, and frankly, made-up terms. This is weird and devious and brutally funny satire. And the really brilliant kicker is that part of the proceeds from every sale go to a champion cause, including the likes of the ACLU, the Sierra Club, the Violence Policy Center, and Equality Now, in an effort to keep the bleak and surreal prophecies included in their pages from ever coming to pass. For those of you who have discovered John Oliver's Marlon Bundo, or Stephen Colbert's Whose Boat Is This Boat, the Whatever Happened To series is your next step into the future. And if you go to whateverhappenedseries.com/constant, you can get a $25 e-subscription right now, with $2 of each book going to the champion cause. That's $22 given away to great causes and 3 measly bucks for the 11 e-books. So go now to whateverhappenedseries.com/constant to get your deal today. The future will thank you, while it still can. A couple of things before we get started. First off, if you haven't listened to our last episode, Mesmerizing, you're probably going to want to go back and do that before diving into this bad boy. Don't worry, I'll wait. Secondly, if you look at the counter on whatever app or page you're listening to this through, you'll notice this one is a bit of a doozy. Thirdly, I feel the need to give a little warning before we go any further. Generally, on this show, I try to look at fairly discrete events, ideas, or people. Here's a thing that happened, or a notion folks believed, or a person who did some stuff. This story is, for better or worse, not like that. It's at once more expansive and more reductive than our usual fare. Frankly, it's a little TED Talk-y, and I mean that in the worst way. I used to have this recurring nightmare where I'd pick a bit of lint out of my belly button, but when I pulled on it, it was more like a string, a long string that kept coming and coming the more I pulled. And matted into it were all kinds of weird detritus and debris, bits of airliner and fruit trees and gobs of mysterious flesh. I always woke up before I managed to get to the end of the string in a cold sweat, my heart pounding, because there was a sense that whatever was at the end, whatever anchored the foul ribbon into my belly, was a ghastly, unspeakable, eldritch horror. I tell you about this, I think you'll agree, far too graphic and disturbing ordeal, because as I was finishing research on the Mesmer episode, I began to feel like I was back in that nightmare again. There was a little bit of string pulled up at the corner of the story, and when I began to grab at it, I could thumb the line and feel the vibration of something deep and huge lurking at the end. So, steel up and grab on. We're going for a fucking ride. Benjamin Franklin was 79 when he managed to duly demolish the professional reputation of Franz Mesmer. By the time he died in 1790, his position as one of the greatest thinkers in one of the greatest ages of greatest thinkers was cemented. And at the time, an itinerant, embittered Mesmer was being boot-kicked out of his homeland in Vienna. That was where we left things, but it's not where things got left. Despite the fame and influence of Franklin and the accordant infamy and impotence of Mesmer, there is an argument to be made that if you look out on the United States of America today, of the two of them, the quack doctor had a greater impact on getting us to where we are than did the founding father. You could make that argument, but I'm the one who's going to. This is The Constant, a history of getting things wrong. I'm Mark Chrysler. Today's episode, The Idea That Broke America. By the time Franklin and Lavoisier issued their report debunking the idea, there were dozens of Mesmer knockoffs operating in Paris and more widely throughout France. And while Mesmer was mortified by their conclusions and fled into obscurity, there were plenty of less embarrassable or less scrupulous practitioners who weren't going to let a little devastating study get in the way of what was either a profound belief or a profitable business. Take your pick. These folks had already been emulating Mesmer in variously loosey-goosey ways. Because few were accredited or trained by the master, most were piecing together patchwork versions of the original therapy. But after Mesmer left Paris, the deviations swelled. Most nobody even knew where he was. He'd virtually disappeared off the face of the earth. If you were a mesmerist or a magnetist, there was a lot of disagreement on what to call this new pseudoscience. After 1785, you had nothing to even compare your procedure to, and no one to check or critique your work. So animal magnetism began to bend in wild new directions as new mesmerists began springing up throughout France, using ideas brought to them through a long-distance game of telephone. One of these third-string mesmerists was Armand Marie Jacques de Chassenay, the Marquis de Puysegur. Puysegur was introduced to mesmerism by his brother, Antoine Hyacinthe, the Count of Chastenay. But it's unclear whether the Count received training in the subject from Mesmer himself, or if he was already operating off a Xeroxed version of the idea. Either way, in 1784, around the same time Franklin and Lavoisier's crew of super scientists were tearing Mesmer's technique apart in Paris, Puysegur started futzing with it in Sazon. Puysegur was a nobleman. He lived in an honest-to-God castle with a sprawling estate on which lived dozens of peasants who were pretty much bound to do his bidding. That meant Puysegur had all the test subjects he could ask for, or rather, command. It also meant that Puysegur was more scandalized by the idea of bringing his patients to, climax. Mesmer had no compunctions with women moaning and screaming in the course of his treatments. In fact, that was probably a feature rather than a bug. But this was, to 18th century France, a sign of his status as a nouveau riche. Because he was a proper French gentleman, Puysegur found Mesmer's crises unseemly. And from the start of his experiments, he began looking for a quieter, more dignified form of magnetism, which he found with his third patient, Victor Race. Race was a young peasant who suffered from some unknown respiratory problem, maybe asthma. When Puysegur mesmerized him, something interesting happened. After 7 or 8 minutes, Race fell asleep, but not normal sleepy sleep. He was still aware, able to speak, listen, take commands. Puysegur was even able to convince the semi-sleeping Race to dance along to music that wasn't actually playing. Even more interesting, when Race woke from the state, he had no memory of the time he spent under the trance. Puysegur was fascinated. He brought back Race again and again, experimenting and playing with his sleepy subject. And he started inducing the same state in other patients and testing out new ideas on them, too. Puysegur believed he'd discovered a new, improved, and more genteel form of magnetic therapy. He at first called it a perfect crisis, a nod to the convulsing parasexual method of his forerunner. Eventually, though, he settled on a different term, artificial somnambulism. What he saw in his somnambulized patients was remarkable. They could be compelled to not feel pain. He would tell a subject that they couldn't feel some part of their body, their leg, say, and then he'd scratch, prick, or burn the poor guy's leg while he sat, half asleep, entirely unawares and unperturbed. He'd give somebody an associative command, like yelp whenever you see the color yellow, and they'd do it. Moreover, even after waking up from the trance, they'd continue to yelp at the same stimulus, even though they purported to not remember getting the directive. If you're thinking this sounds an awful lot like hypnosis, you're right. Mesmer's original version of the therapy already bore a lot of the hallmarks of what we'd now call hypnosis, but Puysegur's went the extra mile. But neither of them realized what they'd found. Eventually, Puysegur abandoned the idea of the mystical magnetic fluid hypothesized by Mesmer in favor of his own idea, that he, the magnetizer, was imposing his will upon the magnetized. But even this revision had a note of the mystic to it. The will Pisagor spoke of was still pretty well connected to Mesmer's magnetism. The credit for the true discovery of hypnosis usually goes either to Scottish surgeon James Braid, who coined the term, or less frequently, Abbé Faria, a Portuguese monk who was the one who actually worked out the idea of suggestion. Sidebar, I've spent a dozen hours over the last few weeks looking into hypnosis, and I don't understand if it's real or not. Generally, if you can't tell whether something is legit or not after that much looking, it's safe to conclude it ain't. But with hypnosis, I'll admit it doesn't appear quite that simple. I think it's pretty safe to say that hypnosis is, at the very least, mainly either the result of, or just plain inseparable from, the placebo effect, which naturally is exactly what Franklin and Lavoisier concluded. But placebo is itself a very real and often powerful phenomenon. So, I don't know. Is that a hedge? Am I waffling? Whatever. I don't want to talk about hypnosis. Sidebar complete. Pisagor would probably have gotten more due if he, like so many people in this ridiculous saga, hadn't been caught up in the French Revolution. But he owned a friggin' castle, so you know he wasn't going to escape notice. He was jailed for several years, and after that, prohibited from speaking about his practices. By the turn of the century, the majority of so-called mesmerists and magmatists were practicing in the mold of Pisagor, but virtually none of them knew his name. Charles Poyen was the son of a plantation worker on the French Caribbean island of Guadeloupe. At some point in the early 1800s, he paid a long visit to the continent, where he learned Pisagor's somnambulism. When he returned to Guadeloupe, he brought mesmerism to the islands, curing diseases, purportedly, putting on hypnotic entertainments, and, so the story goes, teacupping his family's slaves into the sunken place, causing them to work harder and be more obedient. That's almost certainly not true. Even the staunchest of hypnotism advocates will tell you that nobody can be compelled to any action or belief they don't want to take or hold already. But I wanted to make sure that you knew that you don't like Charles Poyen. So keep in mind, when he chanced upon what he believed to be a medical miracle, one of his first thoughts was, I'll bet I can use this to make slavery worse. Poyen didn't stay in the Caribbean long. In 1837, he made his way to New England and brought mesmerism to America. We'll get back to Poyen in a bit, but it's important that we take a little time to explain what he was walking into, because 1830s America was a wacky place. If we venture back a little bit to the beginning of the American experience in the 1760s, the religious landscape of the 13 colonies was pretty simple, if a bit alien to a modern perspective. There were, at the time, basically four dominant religions. On one extreme, you had the Calvinists. Calvinist religious groups made up the bulk of European settlers for hundreds of years, a fact that leads a lot of folks to conclude that the United States was formed as a Christian nation. It absolutely wasn't, and we'll touch on that soon, but what's interesting about those claims is how different Calvinist Christianity is and was from that practiced by those who would have you believe their religion should rule the nation today. When Martin Luther started up the Reformation, he didn't intend or wish to create a new church. He just thought that Catholicism had veered away from Christian truth on a few key points, 95 of them specifically, and hoped to correct that. Henry VIII didn't really have radical separatism in mind either. He thought Anglicanism could look quite a bit like Catholicism, with some key differences, like, you know, maybe he could be the physical embodiment of God's will on earth instead of the Pope. Little things. John Calvin, on the other hand, was a radical. He didn't think Catholicism could be corrected, nor did he care to try. He had a whole, entirely different theology that didn't and wouldn't gel with the Pope's, or Luther's, or Henry's, for that matter. That theology all ushered logically from one simple idea: that God was omnipotent, omniscient, and omnipresent. Not a controversial idea, especially among medieval Christians, but it does create a bit of a paradox. See, if God knows everything, sees everything, and has all power over creation, then how is it that human beings have free will? Catholic and Protestant apologists puzzled and twisted over this riddle for thousands of years. They still do, come to think of it. But Calvin cut through the pedantry. How do humans have free will? Easy. According to Calvin, they don't. No free will. None. God created everything, and God's will animates everything. Nothing that happens is in defiance of his plan. Nothing. The ramifications of this principle to religious worship are tectonic. Take salvation, for instance. According to Catholic dogma, salvation had to be earned through works, some combination of good deeds and sincere contrition and prayer. Luther said, "No, only God's grace can save. You can't earn it. It must be asked for and given by God." But Calvin said, "Earn it? Ask for it? Who said you can do that? God predestined those who will be saved from before they were even born, and there's nothing anybody can do to change his mind." This concept is known as unconditional election, and it means that if God put his mark on you, it didn't matter what you did. You were going to heaven. Reject him? Reject Christ? So what? Murder, rape, and steal? No difference. And on the flip side, if you weren't one of those chosen, it didn't matter what you did. There was no sneaking onto the guest list. Spend all your life praying to God and feeding the hungry if you want. God might be happy to see it, but it's not getting into heaven. And if you were a Calvinist, or are, I should say, it's not like Calvinism has gone away since the 1700s, you had no idea if you were chosen or not. There was no way to know. Calvin's theology was as logically and scripturally consistent as it was deeply depressing and terrifying. The Puritans who settled in New England spent most of their lives trying desperately to prove they were good, humble, spiritual people, all the while living with the dread of knowing they'd only learn whether they escaped eternal damnation when they woke from death in a pit of fire. Fun times! On the other side of the American religious scales were the deists. And I mean way on the other side. It'd be hard to come up with a belief system as totally disparate from Calvinism as what the deists put together. According to the deists, God had nothing to do with anything. Somewhere back in the day, say 6,000 odd years ago, he created the universe and everything on it. And then he ghosted. Holy ghosted. An existential Irish goodbye. All those miracles in the Bible? Never happened. In fact, the Bible itself? Just a book. And Jesus? Well, he seems like a swell guy. Smart chap, for sure. But Son of God? No way. God was long gone by the time Christ arrived on the scene. He did leave us one thing before he jetted, though. Our sense of reason. And that, our reason, was the one tool he gave us for determining between right and wrong, truth and falsity, salvation and sin. The ranks of American deism were probably never very deep, but what the bench lacked in quantity, it made up for in quality. Thomas Paine, who wrote Common Sense in 1776, touching off the American Revolution, deist. Thomas Jefferson, author of the Declaration of Independence, our first Secretary of State, second Vice President, and third President, deist. The president after him, James Madison, probably a deist. Or maybe you've heard of a guy named George Washington? Well, he went to church with his wife and children his whole life, but he refused to ever take communion. And he almost always referred to the Creator rather than God. Pretty dead giveaways that he, too, was at the least sympathetic to deism. Ethan Allen, James Monroe, John Adams, Samuel Adams, deist, Unitarian, split the difference, and deist. And we can't possibly skip noting maybe the most important deist of revolutionary America besides Paine, our buddy Benjamin Franklin. So on one end you've got the Calvinists, and on the very completely other end, you've got the deists. And then in the middle, you've got two, or more like one and a half groups. These were the mainstream Protestants that look most familiar to contemporary Christians today. First, you had the Anglicans, the Church of England, formed by King Henry. Anglicanism lived mainly in the upper and middle class landowners of both the North and South. The WASPs, not trendy or effete enough to join the other founding fathers in deism. And then, among the poor, the indentured, and the enslaved, you had Methodism. Methodism was basically Anglicanism you could dance to. The Anglicans were stuffy, dry, and detached. I'm sure our English listeners find that unbelievable. Whereas Methodists were taking things up-tempo. At their services, they brought up people to testify emotionally as to God's impact on their lives and the destitution and sin from which they'd been delivered. The Methodists were playing with two new ideas that were bound to make a big splash: the belief in a personal God and the need to be born again. All right, you with me? I'm aware this is more history of religion than you'd want or expect from a story about how a hypnotist broke America, but it's going to be important eventually, I promise. In the early 1800s, each of the four primary religious groups in the United States falls onto hard times. The issue for the Calvinists wasn't really new. It was the same thing that had tripped them up from the get-go. They were just super depressing. Hard to sell people on a doctrine that promises them a life of self-denial and worry, and that says your reward for all that toil and strife will be possibly burning in hell anyway. The problem for the Anglicans was simple. The head of their church was King George, who they'd just gone to war with and defeated to create a secular nation apart from. That's awkward. Deism just plain fell out of fashion. It was a belief system almost entirely constrained to upper-crust college boys like Alexander Hamilton. Oh, did I forget to mention that? Yeah, Hamilton was probably a deist too. And upper-crust college boys were, are, and always will be fickle as a five-year-old. By the 1830s, deism's decline was nearly at full apogee, largely eclipsed by a new trendy idea, transcendentalism, which held that God lived in all of nature and all of humanity. Finally, Methodism. The Methodists had been picking up adherents left, right, and center for decades, but in the early 19th century, they hit a bramble bush: slavery. Methodists had been some of the loudest, clearest advocates for abolition in the country, but with tons of Southern slavers leaving the Anglican Church on account of that whole revolution thing, Methodism began to splinter. All of this was the grounds for what's called the Second Great Awakening. With so much religious uncertainty and the rise of Romanticism across the nation, Americans turned to new kinds of religion in vast numbers. Mormons and Jehovah's Witnesses, Adventists and Baptists, Shakers and Congregationalists. It was a new day for American Christianity. Let's leave the Mormons and Jehovah's Witnesses aside, though, because that's a whole different can of worms. The rest of these denominations had some things in common. They shared a lot of the emotional appeals, testimonials, and born-again philosophies of Methodism, but they also brought in some of the guilt, dread, and hellfire of the Calvinists. They believed, for instance, in what Calvin had called the total depravity of man, that all people were enslaved by sin and could not be trusted to seek goodness or God on their own. But, like the Methodists, they believed in free will and in the possible salvation of all mankind, which meant you needed to evangelize like never before. You needed to impress upon all people the terrible and terrifying wages of sin and the glory and grace of salvation. So these groups started a new Christian practice, the revival. Preachers would roll into town and create days-long religious services with music and testimonials and sermons and sales pitches. They'd appeal to the emotions of congregants who would dance and scream and shake in ecstasy. They were traveling entertainments as much as they were religious ceremonies. And there are plenty of actual traveling entertainments in tow too, plays and freak shows and circuses. That was the landscape Charles Poyen wandered into when he brought mesmerism to America in 1837. A country begging for entertainment, sensationalism, emotional catharsis, and new religion. And Charles Poyen didn't fail to deliver. For a French Caribbean immigrant, Poyen strikes me as just about the most American to ever America. He's given to soaring rhetoric about his sincere and heartfelt belief in his science and its ability to change the world for the better. And if that science also got him filthy rich, well, sure, but that's just providence, really. Poyen's demonstrations were part lecture, part sermon, and part P.T. Barnum. Again, so American. He healed the sick and taught about the science of magnetism, but there was as much hypnotism sideshow as there was solemn medicine or dispassionate inquiry. His first big stop was Providence, Rhode Island, where he not only performed nightly, but taught daily. By the time he left for Boston, some months after his arrival, he estimated he'd trained 40 mesmerists in his wake and healed hundreds. The most important of his patients was Cynthia Gleason, a young and beautiful factory worker who complained of insomnia and stomach problems. According to both Poyen and Gleason, magnetism worked wonders for her. One way or the other, It's hard to disagree. Gleason quickly became a regular fixture of Poyen's shows. She was, I think the best way to put it is, the magician's assistant. Poyen would mesmerize her at the top of the performance. Then she'd launch into a routine of cold reading, faith healing, and prestidigitation. Poyen would blindfold Gleason and ask her to identify objects taken from the audience. She would read Poyen's mind. She would diagnose volunteers by staring into their stomachs. The powers of mesmerism, in Poyen's and Gleason's hands, were expanding well beyond hypnotic suggestion or even curing illness. They were downright supernatural. Why it was that Poyen couldn't magnetize other people whom he didn't employ into a state of psychic clairvoyance was easily explained. Gleason was especially weak-minded, he said, and it was her weakness that allowed her to be moved to a place of such power. In fact, the general weakness of the female sex writ large explained why he and so many other mesmerists, including Mesmer himself, remember, preferred working upon women. I don't think I need to comment on that, right? Speaks for itself, yeah. For another of the regular parlor tricks in their routine, Poyen would drop Gleason into a deep sleep and show how nothing could wake her. He could yell or clap, pinch or poke, even fire a gun, and Gleason would continue in her unreachable slumber. Except for one night when, mid-demo, the theater manager ran into the house yelling, "Fire!" at which point Gleason miraculously regained consciousness and bolted for the door. Fancy fucking that, huh? Anybody with even a passing acquaintance to stage magic or cold reading will recognize this stuff. I don't know precisely how Poyen and Gleason achieved their effects, but the question isn't fundamentally mysterious. These were tricks. Even many people at the time realized this. They'd seen magicians before. In response to these criticisms, Poyen wrote, "The experiments which I have performed on Miss G and published in several newspapers have been doubted, even considered by many as the results of a concerted plan. Let the unfair and ungenerous think and say what they please. We can no more prevent the human tongue from exercising its evil activity than stop the impetuous and desolating course of a torrent." He goes on to talk about God knowing the truth and looking poorly upon the hearts of men who doubt him and etc. Convincing, above-board stuff like that. I find Poyen deeply vexing. He published a book entitled Progress of Animal Magnetism in New England. I've read it. And what I can say is that it is full of bombast and hyperbole, logical fallacies and sloppy reasoning, yet it's also brimming over with what I'd call sincerity. Poyen appears to have truly believed not only that animal magnetism was real, but that its discovery was the most important in scientific history. It was the key to understanding all of life and much of the universe. He also believed, again, I think earnestly, that this was the greatest medical discovery of all time. That magnetism held the best or the only cure for most or all disease. Still, he and Gleason engaged actively in fraud. Why? Why would you have to gussy up the most profound revelation in the world? Why lie and exaggerate and flim-flam when you believe you have the truth on your side? There's something keenly American about that, too. But we're not here to talk about Poyen. We're here to talk about how Mesmer's idea mutated into a thing that even now saturates nearly every pore of American being. And Poyen, fascinating and troubling as he is, was just a delivery device. Phineas Parkhurst Quimby was a clockmaker and inventor up until 1838, when Poyen and Gleason brought their mesmeric extravaganza to Belfast, Maine. Quimby was amazed by the show, returning night after night and seeking out Poyen in the day to ask him questions about this medical miracle. When the show hit the road, Quimby hit it too. He followed Poyen like an unbidden disciple for 2 years, until 1840, when he struck out to practice magnetism for himself. This wasn't especially unique of Quimby. Over the course of his touring, Poyen picked up dozens of protégés, students, and hangers-on looking to... what? Better understand the nature of life, heal the sick, make a quick buck? The correct answer, no doubt, is D, all of the above. What made Quimby different, what made him the most important player in this story, maybe, is not how he learned magnetism, but how he changed it. Quimby found his own assistant, Lucius Berkmar, who, like Cynthia Gleason, was supposedly deeply susceptible to magnetism, and the two set out with their own mesmerism show. But before long, Quimby dropped Berkmar and stopped touring. He claimed that he had made a new discovery that supplanted animal magnetism. And this new discovery, he said, allowed him to treat any and all illnesses better than any physician or magnetist in the world. Decades ago, Johann Gassner had thought he was treating the sick through exorcism. Franz Mesmer came along to correct that, saying the healing was actually caused by a magnetic crisis. Then Pussegur amended that, saying you didn't need the crisis, a trance would do. Quimby took things a step further. You didn't need trances or even magnetism at all. Here's Quimby's explanation, in his own words. The trouble is in the mind, for the body is only the house for the mind to dwell in. Therefore, if your mind had been deceived by some invisible enemy into a belief, you have out into it the form of a disease, with or without your knowledge. By my theory or truth, I come in contact with your enemy and restore you to health and happiness. This I do partly mentally and partly by talking till I correct the wrong impression and establish the truth. And the truth is the cure. That's truth, capital T. Back in 1785, Benjamin Franklin and his 18th century science supergroup had concluded that the effects of this so-called animal magnetism came merely from the imagination. In the 1840s, Quimby rocketed right past that notion. Imagination wasn't the cure, but the cause. Every illness, literally anything that could be wrong with you, was due to bad thinking. And all it would take to cure the world would be to correct the errors in the mind of the afflicted and return them to the truth and wisdom of health. Okay, let's catch our breath for a second, because from here on out, it's going to be a lot of names and a lot of ideas, and we're going to plow through them hopefully pretty quickly. The bombastic title of this episode is, you'll remember, The Idea That Broke America. So far, we've gone from a discredited French proto-hypnotist to think yourself healthy. My thesis still seems very much off on the horizon, I'm sure, but trust me, it's closer than it appears. Ready? All right, let's do this. Quimby went on to treat, if you can call it that, hundreds of patients before his death in 1866. Among those patients were four who went on to spread his healing system around the United States and, indeed, the world. Of those four, the name you're most likely to be familiar with is Mary Baker Eddy. Eddy studied with and gained treatment from Quimby through basically the whole of the Civil War, from 1862 to 1865. Her father had been a monstrous jerk who, according to her biographies, beat and punished her regularly in an attempt to break her will. Perhaps because of this suffering, or perhaps in response to it, Eddy developed a bunch of strange maladies. She would regularly break into something like seizures, falling to the ground, shaking, writhing, and shouting before falling unconscious. Quimby's impact on Eddy was profound. In 1862, she wrote a letter to the Portland Evening Courier, which read in part, "With this physical and mental depression, I first visited P.P. Quimby, and in less than 1 week from that time, I ascended by a stairway of 182 steps to the dome of the City Hall, and am improving ad infinitum. To the most subtle reasoning, such a proof, coupled to, as it is, with numberless similar ones, demonstrates his power to heal." Eventually, Eddy and Quimby parted ways. Eddy had come to believe her healing was more to do with Jesus than hypnotism. She founded the Church of Christ Scientist in 1879 and disavowed Quimby. To this day, Christian scientists deny that Quimby's teachings and philosophy had any bearing on her beliefs, despite the fact that she lived with him for 4 years, claiming he cured her and that her doctrine looked very much like his. It's only now that I'm realizing how many extremely litigious people I'm potentially going to piss off with this story. Oh well. Look forward to the Kickstarter for my attorney's fees in the months to come. There's another expressly religious student of Quimby who bears mention too. Warren Felt Evans was a Methodist minister who traveled to Maine in 1863 seeking healing and philosophy from Quimby. He, too, studied with and supposedly was cured by the man, though of what, there's no record to say. Then he struck out on his own, opening a healing center in Claremont, New Hampshire, where he practiced for 20 years. He also wrote a series of books that spread Quimby's ideas throughout the nation. The titles give the gist of what those ideas were: The Mental Cure, Mental Medicine, Soul and Body, The Divine Law of Cure, The Primitive Mind Cure, Esoteric Christianity, and Mental Therapeutics. Then there's Julius and Annetta Dresser, who met in Quimby's office in 1863. Both of them had come seeking cures, also for unnamed, unspecific maladies, which they claim Quimby managed to take on. From there, the couple, married that same year, became Quimby's most devoted disciples. After Quimby died, they publicly accused Mary Baker Eddy of plagiarizing his work and began to write and teach what they said was his unadulterated, pure, healing philosophy. All right, boy, another quick breath, huh? So now we've got our four spiritual descendants, no pun intended, of Quimby. In Boston, there's Mary Baker Eddy and her Church of Christian Science. In New Hampshire, Minister Warren Felt Evans is teaching mental healing. And also in Boston, the Dressers were laying claim to Quimby's legacy through the term that has now become synonymous with the whole of the movement, New Thought. New Thought believed, and continues to believe, because this shit ain't dead by a long shot, that God is everywhere, including in all of life and all humanity. All of existence, then, is the product of the mind, and all illness, as Quimby said, from error or wrong thought. Eddy's Christian Science held a pretty similar belief system, but was more explicitly based upon Christianity, if the name didn't give it away, and didn't see mankind as divine and empowered so much as wrecked and besought. The wrong thinking that plagued humanity with disease was our real power and birthright, and only by God's grace could we hope to remove it and return to health. Most of the mutative steps that get us from here to breaking America come from followers of either Eddy or the Dressers. But before we get back to that, we need to take a quick trip to Scotland. John Alexander Dowie was born in Edinburgh in 1847. The son of a tailor and preacher, he moved with his parents to Adelaide, Australia in 1860. When he was 21, he went back to Edinburgh, where he studied theology. Once ordained as a Congregationalist pastor, he returned to Australia, where he bounced around as head of a few small churches in a few small towns in New South Wales. He got into a bit of trouble for what some congregants saw as his authoritarian impulses, was fined and jailed in 1882. He came to San Francisco in 1888. After his heavily indebted church suspiciously burnt down somehow. Probably nothing, don't worry about it. It was in America that Dowie came into his own. Somehow, probably through the books of Warren Felt Evans, he got the idea to start doing faith healings. He founded a ministry he called the International Divine Healing Association, which he ran as a for-profit commercial enterprise. Parishioners were expected to tithe, giving over 10% of their income to Dowie, and if they did, he would pray for them to be healed. Which sounds kind of like extortion, but whatever. He also engaged in rampant securities fraud, buying up stocks from bankrupt companies and compelling his congregants to purchase them off of him at a steep markup. In 1890, two of his members successfully sued him, and Dowie decided San Francisco wasn't the place for him. He moved then to Chicago, where he found little success up until 1893, when the World's Fair came to town. Dowie rented a tent across from the Great White Way, where he put on divine healing shows. Dowie's healings were dramatic and fantastic. He yelled and screamed, laying on hands, casting out demons, causing the waking to faint, the infirmed to walk, the mute to speak. And sure, most of the people he cured were shills and plants, but if you didn't know that, it must have seemed very impressive. Dowie's fame and success grew exponentially throughout the 1890s. His new ministry was formally called the Christian Catholic Apostolic Church, but informally, most knew it as Zion. There was a huge church and residence called the Zion Home, seven stories high on Michigan Avenue. There was Zion College, Zion Tabernacle, Zion Healing Home, Zion Junior High, and then, in 1900, Dowie staked his greatest claim, Zion, Illinois. A whole city, 40 miles north of Chicago, devoted to him and his church, and also devoted to a heaping helping of Dowie's second favorite thing, securities fraud. residents of Zion weren't allowed to smoke or drink or see doctors. They were also required to put all of their income into the Zion Bank, which Dowie used as a slush fund to bankroll his opulent lifestyle, while preaching frugality and simplicity to his followers. What a fun fucking guy, this one. Eventually, his followers had enough of his multiple palatial estates, carriages, and livery, and he was deposed both from his church and his town. The commonly stated figure is that Dowie defrauded the city and church of somewhere around $3 million. In $1,900! He died in 1907, 2 years after a stroke that had left him at the mercies of his former acolytes, who kept him on a strict and small allowance. For those last years, he was finally forced to live the ascetic life he preached. What does Dowie have to do with anything? Well, for one, his version of faith healing, derived indirectly from Quimby, became the model for nearly all the faith healing you see in 20th century evangelical Christianity. For another, he was a main forerunner of one of those 20th century evangelical denominations, Pentecostalism. And hold on to that, we'll be back here in a few minutes. God, this is exhausting. Back to Christian Science. In 1883, Emma Curtis Hopkins became a student of Mary Baker Eddy's. Her ascent within the Christian Science organization was fast and hard. Within a year, she was the editor of its official journal. A year after that, she was taken out of this position, following an editorial she wrote, which Eddy found too Asian in influence. Hopkins was independent, ambitious, and ruthless. While she lost her place as editor, she started picking off the sympathies and allegiances of many of Eddy's students, ministers, and laity. Somewhere not long after she was removed from the journal, she gave Eddy an ultimatum. She said if Eddy didn't give her full ownership and control of all Christian Science churches west of New York, she would, quote, sweep her off the face of the earth. Eddy declined this generous offer, and Hopkins left the church, moving to Chicago to set up her own center, the Emma Curtis Hopkins College of Christian Science, in 1886, 4 years ahead of Alexander Dowie. Mary Baker Eddy's ministry was hostile to the dressers and to the new thought community more largely, but Hopkins' new organization was welcoming to it. In fact, while Quimby had given birth to its founding ideas and the dressers had carried on its legacy, it was Hopkins who first laid new thought down as a formal religious doctrine, and it's through Hopkins that those ideas really gained steam. In new thought circles, Hopkins is sometimes called the teacher of teachers. She taught and ordained Charles and Myrtle Fillmore, who founded the Unity Church, which is the largest Christian New Thought denomination today, with members including Maya Angelou, Betty White, and Erykah Badu. She taught and ordained Melinda Kramer and Nana Brooks, who founded the Church of Divine Science, which is currently centered in Pueblo. Annie Ricks Militz, who founded Home of Truth. Dr. Emily Cady, author of Lessons in Truth. Ernest Holmes, founder of the Church of Religious Science. The list goes on and on. All right, fine, you're thinking. So a bunch of relatively small churches sprung up under the belief that you could heal the sick through positive thinking. What does that have to do with breaking America? Fair. Fine. Good question. I've got two answers for you. First, by the time Hopkins spread new thought out across the land, it wasn't just about healing anymore. And second, what it was came to touch so much more than just a few churches. One more jump back in time to 1888. Prentice Mulford is a lecturer, poet, and essayist who gets his hands on some of the writings and ideas of the dressers. Remember, Phineas Quimby had mostly been concerned with health. He thought disease was due to wrong thought. But by the time his exponents made their way to Mulford, the idea is so much bigger. The mental world is the real one, the living quarters of God and his divine influence on all living things. The material world is merely a physical manifestation of that mental one, and its flaws are all on account of the kinks and hang-ups between the perfection of God and the errors of man's mind. Therefore, getting your thought right doesn't just hold the key to physical and mental wellness, it holds the key to everything. In 1888, Mulford publishes Your Forces and How to Use Them, in which he popularizes a new phrase, the Law of Attraction. Maybe that sounds familiar to you because of this.
A year ago, my life had collapsed around me. I'd worked myself into exhaustion, My father died suddenly, and my relationships were in turmoil. Little did I know at the time, out of my greatest despair was to come the greatest gift. I'd been given a glimpse of a great secret.
In 2006, Rhonda Byrne produced The Secret, a nearly unwatchable film that took the media by storm, with advocates including daytime television moguls Oprah Winfrey and Ellen DeGeneres. The titular secret of The Secret is that everything you want can be yours if you only believe it.
Do you know this secret gives you everything you want? Happiness, health, and wealth.
You can have, do, or be anything you want.
We can have whatever it is that we choose. I don't care how big it is.
What kind of a house do you want to live in?
Do you want to be a millionaire?
What kind of a business do you want to have?
Do you want more success?
What do you really want?
I've seen many miracles take place in people's lives. Financial miracles, miracles of physical healing, mental healing, healing in relationships.
All of this happened because of knowing how to apply the secret.
If you're a positive person, your life will be good. If you're a negative person, your life will be bad. Because positive outcomes and negative outcomes are attracted to your thoughts. The law of attraction. At the time of its release, The Secret may have seemed novel, but it was only a repackaging of a notion that had already come to dominate American society over the last century.
I couldn't believe all the people who knew this.
When Hodges' many disciples set out into the world, the law of attraction, or some variation thereon, is a key fixture of New Thought. In addition to the promise of healing the sick, came the promise of enriching the poor. Both could be achieved merely by correcting your thoughts and attuning them with God. Almost every part of the American New Age movement was and is influenced by New Thought. But it's not just these new churches that glom onto this idea. Steel magnate Andrew Carnegie took to it, arguing that riches are a sign of the morality and rightness of their possessors. Henry Ford thought it sounded pretty good too, as did Horatio Alger, who wrote a series of books about poor put-upon boys who rise to wealth and greatness through the virtue of their character. E.W. Kenyon was a Methodist deacon up until 1892, when he caught the acting bug and left Amsterdam, New York, to train at the Emerson School of Oratory in Boston. There, it seems, he encountered and assimilated New Thought into his personal philosophy, which he then brought back to American Christianity when he returned to ministry at the Bethel Bible Institute. Kenyon then spread these New Thought ideas into the newly forming Pentecostalist movement, of which, you'll remember, Dowie was a predecessor. By the 1950s, Kenyon's New Thought ideas had embedded themselves fully within a new brand of Christianity, prosperity gospel, the doctrine that God rewards faith, positive attitudes, and religious donations with physical well-being and material riches. Prosperity gospel then ran roughshod over the American people. With the birth of televangelism in the 1960s, prosperity gospel preachers like Oral Roberts, Reverend Ike, and Jim and Tammy Faye Baker took hold of the airwaves. They've still got it. Today, three of the four largest churches in America teach prosperity gospel, including Lakewood Church, home of this dickweed.
Well, God bless you. It's always a joy to come into your homes. And if you're ever in our area, please stop by and be a part of one of our services. I promise you, we'll make you feel right at home. But thanks so much for tuning in, and thank you again for coming out today. And I want to talk to you today about remember your dream. All of us have things that we're believing for, something that we want to accomplish. Deep down, we know it's a part of our destiny. We can feel it so strongly. But then we hit some setbacks. We didn't get the promotion. The medical report wasn't good, or a relationship didn't work out. Life has a way of pushing our dreams down. They can become buried under discouragement, buried under past mistakes. There are dreams buried under divorce, buried under low self-esteem. And it's easy to settle for mediocrity, even though we have all this potential buried on the inside. But just because you gave up doesn't mean God gave up. Your dream may be buried. The good news is it's still alive. It's not too late to see it come to pass.
Joel Osteen, and you know what? I don't think that's how his name is pronounced, and I'm not going to get it right. Joel Osteen's church gets around 43.5 thousand butts in the seats weekly, in addition to the millions who view him throughout the world on television. All of that? Prosperity Gospel. New Thought. Phineas Quimby, Armand Puseguir, Franz Mesmer. Other prosperity advocates wrote books. Norman Vincent Peale was pastor at Marble Collegiate Church in New York. But he's best known for his best-selling book, The Power of Positive Thinking, which combines all the emptiest of New Thought, evangelical, and self-help hooey into one glob of gobbledygook, which has sold to date more than 5 million copies. And speaking of self-help, the whole industry? It's New Thought. From James Allen's pivotal 1902 book, As a Man Thinketh, to Napoleon Hill's Think and Grow Rich, to Dale Carnegie's How to Win Friends and Influence People, basically every book in the self-help section of your local bookstore is predicated on New Thought, the Law of Attraction, Prosperity Gospel, or some combination thereof. And hey, one more bridge to jump. From self-help, we get to science. Yes, science, because a majority of Americans who think they know what quantum physics is, they think it's this.
Quantum physics.
Power of thought.
Modern materialism.
What God was.
What is reality?
It's reality. It's
living in a big holodeck.
Inside of your head.
Different levels of truth.
What the Bleep Do We Know is a hit 2004 pseudo-documentary that claims to be about quantum mechanics, but was actually a propaganda piece for Ramtha's School of Enlightenment, a cult out of Yelm, Washington, formed by Jay-Z Knight, who says he channels a 35-year-old being called Ramtha, who, guess what, teaches New Thought.
The only way that I will ever be great to myself is not what I do to my body, but what I do to my mind.
What I thought was unreal now, for me, seems in some ways to be more real than what I think to be real, which seems now more to be unreal.
Don't stop to diagram that sentence or your head will explode. You see how we're beginning to wrap it up here? Self-help, charismatic Christianity, New Age religion, the power of positive thinking. It's all deluded mesmerism, a theory debunked by Benjamin Franklin more than 200 years ago, but still going strong today. In fact, Mesmer's legacy has assimilated Franklin too. One of Franklin's most famous sayings is, "God helps those who help themselves." Of course, we know that Franklin was a deist who didn't believe God actually did anything to help those who helped themselves. That was his point. You've got to do it yourself because nobody else is going to. But in the world of modern America, Franklin's idea is twisted into meaning, think positively about yourself and God will reward you. Practically the exact opposite of his intent. If you're thinking now, all right, fine, that's all very interesting. But I don't watch Joel Osteen, or subscribe to New Age religion, or read self-help books, and neither do tons of people I know. So just how do you suppose this idea broke America? I've got another two answers for you. The first is that, whether you personally adhere to any of these exponents of mesmerism or not, you're in them all the same. The basic equation that wealth equals goodness and poverty equals, if not sin, then at least a personal failing, that's everywhere. Yeah, that second part is implied, isn't it? If you believe that prosperity is a reward from God or the net result of thinking right, then what is being poor? It's a sign that you're doing wrong, or thinking wrong, or being wrong. What's interesting is that the very conservative Pentecostals and the very liberal New Thought folks like Unity Church both subscribe to this extremely noxious idea, even though it's totally at odds with the ostensible values of both sets. Why should lefty New Agers be interested in social safety nets when the problem, all problems, are just mental blockages? Who needs food stamps when you can strike at rich selling Dreamweavers in Santa Fe as long as you put your mind to it? And on the other side, the right-wing Christian side? Well, listen to this.
Have you ever asked God for forgiveness?
Yeah.
I'm not sure I have. I just go and try and do a better job from there. I don't think so. I think if I do something wrong, I think I just try and make it right. I don't bring God into that picture. I don't. And Norman Vincent Peale, the great Norman Vincent Peale, was my pastor. The power of positive thinking. Everybody's heard of Norman Vincent Peale. He was so great.
Oh, I'm sorry. Did I neglect to mention that President Donald Jehoshaphat Trump was a congregant of New Thought, Prosperity Gospel, and self-help icon Norman Vincent Peale? How fucking clumsy of me. I remember seeing this clip before the 2016 election and thinking, holy crap, this guy's sunk. No way the evangelicals are going to line up behind this heretic. Never asked for forgiveness for your sins? Anything else you want to let him know? Have you ever gotten your forehead wet? Eaten crackers with wine? He's done, I thought. Oh, how wrong I was. As I'm recording this, Trump has a 66% approval rating with American white evangelicals, and that's by far the lowest that number has ever been. What I failed to understand, or part of what I failed to understand at least, was that there are two or three whole generations of white American evangelicals who have been, to one degree or another, inculcated to the idea that material wealth is a symptom of moral and spiritual righteousness. Or, as the Calvinists said so long ago, there are visible signs of salvation. The Pentecostal and charismatic movements of the early to mid-20th century, like Kenyon, like Dowie, sought to return Christianity to a pure original state, free from the adulterations of Catholicism or Lutheranism or even Calvinism. The irony of New Thought's influence upon them, then, is that literally no one who ever lived before the year 1900 would possibly recognize Donald Trump's answer as even resembling Christianity. Yet here we are. Franz Mesmer, Armand Puseguer, Charles Poyen, Phineas Quimby, E.W. Kenyon, Norman Vincent Peale, Donald Trump. Hey, look, even though this is now the single longest episode I've ever made, it's still incomplete. I'm sure there are a few theologians out there champing at the bit to explain how Reverend Richard Mather or Jonathan Edwards get us from there to here, and a few philosophy majors longing to interject Bishop Berkeley or Descartes or Spinoza, or economists with Adam Smith, or the list goes on. It's a complex tapestry. And it's fair to question whether any particular thought or thinker needs to be called upon to explain humanity's ancient instincts towards classism, othering, and self-justification. There's a famous quote, commonly attributed to John Steinbeck, that says poor Americans think of themselves not as an exploited proletariat, but as temporarily embarrassed millionaires. This always seems at odds with the American urge to spit upon those in dire straits. But, viewed through the influence of Quimby and his progeny, it makes perfect sense. Yes, you and I may both be poor, but because I am a good person, I eventually will not be. You, on the other hand, are exactly where your character deigns you to be. It's not the only way to explain things, sure. But when I look out upon this nation with its knee-jerk instincts to upbraid and punish the poor, to cheer and absolve the rich, to think of the state of affairs, however grim, as somehow part of a proper order, I see the bizarre influence of a disgraced French para-hypnotist passed and mutated through the centuries into this. The idea that broke America. Music for this week's episode from Lee Rose Vare, Blue Dot Sessions, and Anime is Trash. Thanks to everyone who subscribed, rated, and reviewed. If that doesn't include you, don't despair. You can be a part of my wide and deep gratitude today, right this very minute. I know that every show you listen to asks you to rate and review, but for me and for the constant, it really matters. If you're listening to this, you're still on the ground floor. As opposed to most of the podcasts you listen to, which have hundreds of thousands or even millions of listeners, we're still a relative small fry, and rating and reviewing the show has a big, oversized impact on how the holy algorithms deem us worth showing to new potential fans. So please take a second and help us out. And a very special thanks to Paul Edwards, who helped sponsor this season at the Constantine level, and who dedicates this episode to all those who teach, especially parents. Removing the blindfolds from history promotes humility. Thank you, Mark. A warm embrace to Allison, Lewis, EJ, K, Katie, Brandon, William, and Hannah. Never stop learning, never stop questioning. This was a different kind of episode than usual in terms of length and content and overt politicalness. How'd it work for you? Let us know over at our Facebook group, facebook.com/theconstantpodcast, or via Twitter, where our handle is @constantpodcast. Next week, something a little smaller, huh? Until then, from Chicago, Illinois, where, well, where too many of the events, people, and institutions of this episode featured, frankly, what's up, Chicago? Let's cool it off on the rogue religious ideas, huh? This has been The Constant. Fuck you, Mary Baker Eddy. This sentence is worse than anything I write.